Welcome to the Future Thinkers Podcast. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yulia Ivanova. And this podcast is all about the future. Hey guys, this is episode number 26 of the Future Thinkers Podcast. And today we're very happy to tell you that we have Vinay Gupta on the podcast again. Last year, we had a great conversation with Vinay, and a lot of you guys have sent in comments, specifically commenting on the meditation and enlightenment aspects of the conversation. So we wanted to invite Vinay on the show again to talk about those things in more detail. And so this conversation ended up being 4.5 hours long. Anyway, we had to separate the episode into several chunks, and this is the first chunk. Before we get started, I wanted to thank the people who have sent us donations recently. Thank you to Matthew, Keith, Joseph, Stephen, and Julian. You guys rock.
Yeah, thanks guys. We really appreciate it. Don't forget to come join us in our Google Hangouts. We do it every week, so we want to thank you in person. Just log into the Patreon dashboard and we'll leave a link there telling you when and how to get into it. Before we get into it, guys, I need to apologize for the audio quality. Our audio recorder broke halfway through this episode, so we basically are using Skype audio on our end. Fortunately, Vinay was recording on his end, so his audio is perfectly fine. Also, this episode talks a lot about the dogmas and untruths about enlightenment. I think it's really important that we get this through what enlightenment is and what it isn't so that people don't have the same old dogmas they've always had about enlightenment. So that's what this episode's about. And in the next one, we talk about Vinay's story, how he achieved enlightenment, what his description of enlightenment is. That one gets more into the practical side of it, which is interesting. So we hope you enjoy this episode and we'll get right into it.
I'm excited for this one.
Yeah, I kind of have that feeling like, oh God, here we go.
So you were the most popular episode for us last year.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
You got our brains going too. I think you got our listeners pretty excited. So we got lots to talk about.
It was a really, really fun show.
Yeah, it was.
That was one of the best, most fun interviews I've ever done.
Cool.
Awesome.
Hakuna Matata Space Sparrow, that was...
Yeah, I knew as soon as you said that, like, okay, this is going to be a classic.
Yeah. So, Vinay, last time we talked, something that kind of blew my mind, I did not expect when we were talking, was you said you were enlightened. I wasn't prepared to ask you questions about that, but since we talked to you last, we've had a ton of experiences over the last year. Well, we've meditated a lot more. We've read a lot about meditation, and we've had some experience with it that I could say would be mini Satoris. So I'm interested to hear your opinion on this. This is what this episode is going to be about. So why don't you tell us about your experiences? What is enlightenment?
The first thing is, it's a terrible idea. Right, it's really not the kind of thing that anybody ought to be chasing unless they've left themselves with no alternative. You know, nobody really tells you that at the beginning of the process. The Zen guys hint at it a little bit, like, you know, best not to start, but if you start, best to finish, all this kind of stuff. You know, once you start drilling away at the deep structure of the mind, you know, once you see a little bit of light on the other side, you're more or less compelled to finish the job. So in some ways, it's better to leave everything running pretty much the way that it was and deal with the world in an ordinary way. But if you are, you know, foolish enough or hungry enough to kind of poke that initial little hole, then you find yourself drawn further and further and further to scrape away reality until you get, you know, out into the other side where you, of course, discover simply reality. You know, you're just successively replacing one kind of ignorance with a different kind of ignorance. But that second kind of ignorance is fundamental ignorance. It's the knowledge of the things, you know, the limits of knowing, and living, fully living with the limits of knowing in a way that we normally obscure for ourselves.
It's interesting because when I hear people talk about enlightenment, they say it's sort of a no limit thing. And you're saying it's just another level of limit.
Okay, so for most of us, most of the time, you look up at the night sky and you say, oh, look, stars. And that's sort of where the process stops. If I look up the night sky, you know, I get hit right in the head with, you know, I'm just looking into a 13 billion, you know, light year deep abyss. And I'm sitting on top of a spinning rock, and the only thing that's holding me down is the curvature of space-time. You know, I could damn near feel the rotation of the Earth, you know, as you just kind of stare up like, wow, you know, I'm spinning really, really quickly on this enormous ball of rock being held down by a force I don't really understand, staring into a 13 billion light year abyss. Amazing. And the thing is that, you know, if I didn't know the physics of what was happening, even in this kind of arm-waving way, I'd be staring up and I'd be saying, oh my God, it's the infinite mystery, right? The infinite mystery is not so infinite and not so mysterious now. We've got science, we've got cosmology, we've got lots of good answers to pretty fundamental questions. Almost all of the questions about human nature that have been traditionally answered by, you know, mysticism or religion are now answered pretty adequately by science, particularly evolutionary biology. So we have a lot more certainty about the way the world is. What we don't have so much is cultural understanding of how to live now that we have that certainty. You know, I mean, you know, you've got a billion years of ancestors and we know roughly what shape almost all of them were. And we know that if we manage to get humanity off planet, we could potentially expand through what appears to be right now an almost infinite empty cosmos. And that process could run for, I don't know, hundreds of billions of years, maybe. And we're somewhere in the middle of that process. When you live with that kind of stuff right in front of you, not veiled by the normal processes of ordinary life, you know, you're constantly taking part in this cosmic evolutionary process, but there's nothing mystical about that cosmic evolutionary process. It's the cosmic evolutionary process. Does this kind of make any kind of sense, or is this a little insane sounding?
No, absolutely.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
I've often just, like you described, sat out there and looked at the stars and kind of felt like I was, you know, strapped to the end of a roller coaster, and like you said, almost feeling the earth rotating. So it's interesting. So why would someone not want to pursue enlightenment?
Okay, so you've got to kind of think about this in terms of processes. I will argue that the enlightened state is the natural state of human beings, right? That we more or less start enlightened. It's hard to do this without metaphysical speculation, but for the sake of argument, let's say that reincarnation is plausibly real. In Buddhism, the belief is that beings are formed in a non-enlightened state, and then they have to find their way up through the muck to enlightenment, and that this is the way in which suffering is exited. The Hindus have a slightly different take, which is we think that beings are born enlightened, and then they create the unenlightened state of being as a special purpose experience, in much the same way that you might go into a movie theater. So the sort of notion is that the unenlightened state is created by a conscious, willful limitation of consciousness to narrow focus, to narrow the agenda down to something which is more enjoyable. And you could sort of think of this a bit like, you know, if you're going to be on a long-haul plane flight, you might want to have a couple of drinks and zonk out in front of a movie rather than sit there for, you know, 14 hours with the total awareness of everything that's happening around you going by second by second by second by second. You know, distraction is actually kind of pleasant sometimes, and often it's useful. So what you might call ordinary consciousness, the unenlightened state, is a special purpose state of being that's created to give rise to the ordinary human experience. If the ordinary human experience is good, there's no particular need to reach for enlightenment. If the ordinary human experience is bad, the enlightened experience is an alternative that you might want to try as an alternative. If it turns out to suit you better, great. If it doesn't, well, now you're stuck with it. And I think that it's really important that people don't, you know, say, well, ordinary consciousness is crap. We're going to go out there and find enlightened consciousness. Ordinary consciousness is better than enlightened consciousness for nearly all people, nearly all the time, which is why they cling to ordinary consciousness so hard and avoid enlightened consciousness at all costs. That clinging to the ordinary is not a symptom of some kind of pathology. It's not a symptom of an illness. It's not a disease of the mind. You know, it turns out that that stuff works really well for most of what's important to people, and perfectly reasonably, they cling to what works for them, right? There is no special prize for being the highest person in the world. It's not like it confers divine godlike powers. It's not like it gets you, you know, free entrance to movies. Everything stays the same. You just look at the world in a completely different way. And is that completely different way in some way realer than unenlightened consciousness? Yes, it's pretty clearly a superset of ordinary consciousness, right? Enlightened consciousness includes ordinary consciousness plus a whole bunch of other stuff. But at the end of the day, we've had enlightened beings on this planet for a really long time, and I think you could make a pretty good argument that on average they've made things worse rather than better.
How so?
Well, I mean, is religion good for humanity or bad for humanity?
That's an easy one. But what about the religions that cause you to focus inward, like Buddhism and Hinduism? Are they still bad for the world?
You can argue that Hinduism has been pretty neutral. You could argue that Buddhism has been neutral or positive. But when it goes wrong, I mean, you know, Tibetan Buddhism was this terrible fusion of, you know, Tibetan medieval feudal theocracy with an Enlightenment tradition. So your local medieval landowner was a monastery that still had a military and a police force associated with them and enforced, you know, medieval brutality against the local peasants, but now you're being punished by a Buddha. I'm not really sure that this is beneficial for anybody. Obviously, the same thing is happening all across Catholicism, it's all across Islam. You know, there's no real sense that these regimes were any better than they would have been if there'd been no religious component to their rule. And if the peasantry didn't believe that God was on the side of their masters, maybe they would have been a little more vicious in fighting back when the occasion arose.
Right.
So I think you have to really say, you know, if people are going to be pursuing consciousness, why are they going to do any better at helping out the world than the people that pursued consciousness before them? We've had a long heritage of people pursuing consciousness. Where exactly is it getting us? You know, is it working?
So then what's the point? What would be the point?
Well, so remember what I said about if you know, scrape away the crap and make a little kind of queen spot where you can see the light on the other side? Once you get that far, you will very likely be compelled by your curiosity and, you know, desire to finish the process. So once you get a glimpse of, like, I have this feeling that I might actually be God, that would be a little strange, but maybe I should check. You know, once that thought occurs to you in a real way, once you see some glimmer of infinity inside of you, the tendency is to kind of pursue that knowledge until you get the entire thing out. You know, it's like if you're, you know, looking for fossils or, you know, in a mine looking for diamonds and, you know, you chip away a piece of rock and behind it there's something beautiful and clear and crystalline, you're not going home until you've got that thing out of the rock and you know what it is. You know, so once you have that, you know, initial glimpse of that kind of interior infinity, or you see the kind of mystical wonder in everyday life, once that little spark is there, it's pretty hard to let it go. And that naturally results in this kind of unraveling of identity until you sit there in this kind of, you know, crystalline bright silence. And then the question is, well, okay, now what? What do I do with this?
What have you chosen to do with it? I mean, it's actually interesting that you're so active in Ethereum and technical
real life.
real life, exactly. So how come you're not in a cave somewhere right now?
Well, so I spent 2 years after I got enlightened. I got enlightened in, it must have been 98, 99? I spent a couple of years working at a web design job. I rented a nice apartment. You know, I kind of lived a pretty good ordinary life for a while. And had no concerns outside of my personal sphere of influence. And I was just letting the enlightenment settle in, because the 2 years after you get enlightened are often really, really difficult and traumatic, because you're walking around in the world with enormous hypersensitivity, very little filtering of your consciousness. Everything seems, you know, wonderful, terrible, absurd, and all these other emotions all on top of each other. You don't really necessarily know how to perform your social role now that the entire world seems like this endless kabuki theater. So after I had a couple of years of settling in, I think we talked about this last time we talked, I had this kind of dream or vision in which I was shown the very real possibility that the Earth was going to die and all the people were going to die, and it was going to create the world's worst pile of bureaucratic paperwork in the netherworld, where all of these people were going to be relocated to a new planet to continue their incarnation cycle. And the entire thing was like Douglas Adams or you know, it was this perfect kind of absurdism, but it was this kind of friendly, cheerful, almost British absurdism. It was kind of like Monty Python's Guide to the Netherworld. Well, you see, if they all die at the same time, we have to do the paperwork and we can't face 100,000 years of listening to people complain. So, you know, and it was this notion that there was kind of a mass call-up, that anybody with any unfulfilled spiritual potential was being asked to go forth and do something to try and preserve life on Earth. And, you know, after the dream vision thing ended, and I was stone cold sober at the time, after it ended, it was kind of like, wow, what the hell was that? And, you know, there was this kind of settling in process. And over the course of the next few weeks, a totally new set of motivations arose inside of my being. I just found myself suddenly becoming directly, personally bothered by the state of the world. I began to realize that human extinction really was a possibility within my lifetime. And I really began to just get pulled more and more and more into this kind of activist mode that I'd been in for a long time. But it all came out of essentially a vision, and the vision was completely ridiculous.
That's so interesting.
It's completely bonkers, but that's okay. That's just what happened. And I think it's very important, by the way, that we keep an open mind about the value of spiritual experience. You know, everybody wants their spiritual experiences to be final, definitive revelations of absolute truth, and they want them to generate certainty rather than uncertainty. And people have been at that game on this planet for probably as long as we've had mushrooms. You know, people have always gotten into a position where they take their psychedelic experiences or their spiritual illuminations or their artistic breakthroughs, and then they run around telling everybody they've made a discovery about the nature of the absolute. And these discoveries about the nature of the absolute almost never agree with each other. So I think it's safe to say that what people are seeing, although it appears to them to be absolute, is still relative. And this is really critical. As a kind of, you know, student of comparative religion, everybody will tell you that all the saints and sages say exactly the same thing until you actually look at what they say, and then you discover they all said different things.
Right.
Right? All you need is love. Well, apart from sometimes you need force, will. You know, all you need, peace is all that there is. Well, you know, apart from this thing where you have to fight back against your persecutors, you know, you should be a fearless warrior like the Japanese. And, you know, you just kind of look at the details, and so actually these people agree on almost nothing. In almost all cases, they have an enlightenment experience, and they immediately cast the enlightenment experience into the forms that are available to them from the culture that they're in.
What is your perception on some of the New Age law of attraction type, you know, I don't know if you could call them religions, but whatever they are popping up?
Yeah, I think they should all be fed into a wood chipper. Right? Several of the most prominent teachers should be fed into a wood chipper feet first. Because, you know, what they're doing is they're preying on the most predatory and selfish aspects of Western civilization and turning them into a spiritual path.
Right.
Right? You know, by all means, have your wealth from this law of attraction stuff, but then you're spending all of this stuff to buy crap that was made in China by people who are living in what amounts to prison labor.
Yeah.
And you're pretending that in some way this wealth is clean because it came to you after you did your meditation. Right? Doesn't matter how high you are spiritually, if you are consuming products that were made by slave labor, you're still in the system. And you might be consuming products that were not made by slave labor. You know, oh yeah, we only buy organic local. You know, everything we have is, you know, handmade raw materials. But you're then resting on top of a culture which is running on top of Chinese factory prisons. You know, okay, you didn't do it, but the people that made your car did it. You didn't do it, but the people who made your house did it. You didn't do it, but your doctor did it. You know, if you pull all of the suffering, you know, all the coercion, all the places where people are having guns and sticks pointed at them to make them obey, if you pull all of that stuff out of our society, there'd be damn near nothing left.
Yeah.
No computers, no phones, you know, most of our engineering artifacts, large parts of our buildings, most of our clothes, all of that stuff just evaporates. So the forms of enlightenment where people become, I don't even want to say enlightenment, the forms of spirituality, quote unquote, where people become enormously self-satisfied that they are okay and they've done the right thing and they've purified themselves and that's why their lives are fantastic, in a world which is deeply, deeply, deeply troubled, this approach is not okay. It's a sign that what they've done is they've deluded themselves that what is inside of their head is more important than what's around them. And I literally mean these people should be fed into wood chippers. They're just awful for the world. They're bad for people. They're a smokescreen of false enlightenment, and it's a false enlightenment which is completely compatible with success inside of modern capitalism, even while modern capitalism is slavery powered on one side and ecocidal on the other. Anybody that can tell themselves that their spirituality makes them perfectly comfortable with that situation, right? If this, and I'm not saying that everybody has to have, you know, an outward facing engaged spirituality in the way that I've chosen to. Right? If you are somebody that has broken through the shackles and what you see on the other side is something that says the best thing that you can do for the world is to sit on your butt, contemplate what is happening and project truth into nature, I'm perfectly happy with the monastics that choose to do that. they're contributing as little as they can to the problem, and they're largely convinced that clear consciousness is the only thing that they really have to offer the world. I think those people are incredibly important to the function of our civilization in all kinds of really subtle ways. But that's a very different thing from this approach that says that you can take the fruits of the civilization in the form of wealth without taking responsibility for where that wealth was generated.
What about some of the older paths of enlightenment, like Buddhism and Hinduism and Chinese meditation? And you seem to have picked a side with Hinduism. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I'm Indian. I was vaguely around it when I was a kid. My teachers were Hindu. You know, my teacher's teachers were weird Hindu. That whole thread of my life backs into the immortal yogi tradition of India. But all of this stuff is pre-medieval peasant belief systems. They didn't know any astronomy, they didn't know any, you know, cosmology, they didn't know any evolutionary biology. You know, the fundamental fabric of the universe around them was mysterious. And if they saw the world clearly, what they saw was mystery. But in actual fact, we know an awful lot now about how things really are. You know, I think that evolutionary biology is the one truth that we have more evidence of than practically anything else. You know, it's not that unreasonable to me that we might make some completely transformative discoveries about fundamental physics that explain why there are so many weird particles and why so much of the cosmology we have makes no sense and answers dark matter and all the rest of this kind of stuff. So I think that it's possible that our current physics will turn out to be fairly shoddy compared to what replaces it. There are lots and lots and lots of very big weird anomalies in physics that are wide open for explanations. On the other hand, I think our evolutionary biology is pretty well nailed down. You know, the fossil record is, I don't want to say complete, but we've got an awful lot of the fossil record. We are pretty certain about the order in which things evolved. We've got lots of really, really great evidence from the DNA of living animals about what was descended from what and where things branched from each other. The fundamental implication of that is that you can look at a human being across a room and have very near certainty about what that human being is. It's a collection of atoms reproducing on a set of templates that have evolved over a billion years. And all the questions about human nature that we have, very nearly all of that stuff immediately resolves into basically replicator economics. And that was a perspective that was not available to the Buddha. It was not available to the ancient Hindus. It hasn't been available to anybody until Darwin. And I still think that the spiritual world is having a real problem actually accepting Darwin. And what Hinduism means, right? The Hindu's name for Hinduism is Sanatana Dharma, typically translated as eternal truth. The problem is that if you say eternal truth in the West, what people hear is God said so. And that's not what eternal truth means in India. What eternal truth means in India is that which has never been contradicted by experience. Everywhere that we went across space and time, these things were still the case. I would argue that any, you know, reasonable form of Hinduism has to fully accept biological evolution and has to throw out anything in the tradition which is incompatible with biological evolution, because as far as I can tell, we are certain of biological evolution as the origin of human beings. You can ask some questions about what happened in the first stages of evolution when the first replicators existed. Did they fall from space in pods? Did they evolve from, you know, patterns on crystals? You know, was it something to do with primordial soup and lightning bolts? I agree that the science there is indeterminate. We may never know. It might just be too long ago with no remaining evidence. We don't know. But everything after the point where the fossil record begins is pretty much nailed down to the plank. There's just no doubt about what happened. Not that I'm aware of, anyway. So inside of that framework, what is it then to be a replication machine asking about its own nature? You see what I'm saying? Right? I mean, you have to take the fossil record at face value. When we inquire into human nature, what you're staring into is a billion years of replicator history. And that's an absolute answer as to what a human being is. There may be some kind of additional quality of consciousness which is revealed by meditation. For many people, there is. But that process is being carried out in a body which is unambiguously the result of a historical biological process. And nobody's really taken that on the nose.
So in this whole picture, what is consciousness from your perspective?
So I can tell you what I've experienced and I can tell you what I can justify. So what I can justify is that consciousness is an emergent process that evolves in higher social animals to allow them to model the behavior of other animals. And I think all of our evidence points that, you know, social intelligence evolves in a way that drives the sort of general intelligence that we have. Now, all of that said, if you meditate and you get enlightened, you will almost certainly get a shatteringly intense insight into the nature of this kind of universal cosmic mind that appears to be inside of all beings and all matter simultaneously. And afterwards, you can look at things like ants, and you can clearly see that ants perceive themselves to be people. You know, there doesn't appear to be any fundamental difference in the personness of anything. You know, moths, of, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, if I'm in a position where I am careless, you know, watching something like a, you know, bugs frying themselves against a streetlight is actually upsetting because it looks like people. So we have two qualities here. There's what we could justify from the biological framework of reality around us, which we can see, and there's this kind of intuitive insight that whatever it is that makes things alive also confers on them a sense that they have an individuality, an existence, a knowledge of self. And that's easy to see with the higher animals like dogs, but, you know, if you think of, for example, the Jains in India, they're a religious sect that will sweep bugs out of their path with brooms so that they don't kill anything by existing. They'll only eat fruit because they say the fruit is being freely offered by the tree, but a root vegetable is being pulled up by violence. It's not really easy to make that work as a lifestyle on this planet, but they certainly give it a try. There is a fundamental thing that people perceive when they do enough spiritual practice. And you must know 500 accounts of this stuff. You know, people regularly have the experiences and then write down what happened to them as closely as they can. But what people from every culture have tried to do with those experiences is tell each other that they've discovered the exact objective truth, and everybody now has to listen to what they say. And this is where we go wrong. I think that it's much more intelligent, much more reasonable for us to say that this is an unexamined aspect of human nature. We've got long historical records of people having these experiences, and that we should start to study these experiences from the perspective of science. And I don't necessarily mean sticking people in MRI machines, but let's actually try and catalogue and document what happens to people when they get enlightened. You know, okay, so what happened to you? Who were you before? Who were you afterwards? What did you see? What changed? What happened to you? How did it affect your psychology? How did it affect your relationships? How did it affect your family? What did you then go on to do with your life? And you could bring the Enlightenment tradition back inside of a scientific paradigm that allows examination and learning about it. Because I'm pretty convinced that the sum total of knowledge inside of the world's Enlightenment traditions amounts to two things. A reasonable amount of practical technique for getting people there, and an enormous amount of total horse crap which is layered all over the situation by medieval peasants that had no idea what a human body was made of. And we have to take the experience, because I think the experience is really quite worthwhile. Much as I sound like I'm down on enlightenment, I really just don't want people chasing it for no good reason. And then we have to separate off all of the traditional mythology around it, and we have to throw it right the hell out of court. And then we have to look at the experience again with everything that we've learned since these bloody books were written, and then we have to reintegrate it into our knowledge base, right? So what I would love to see is a scientific tradition of enlightenment that took everything we know about how to do science around human minds and applied it to the enlightenment experience. I mean, you know, I can't see another sensible way of proceeding with this, because if we accept the medieval mysticism around the stuff, every culture has its own brand of medieval mysticism. They all disagree with each other, and many of them come with horrendous consequences, like attempting to regulate other people's sex lives. And because people continue to perceive the Enlightenment experience as conveying divine authority, we're in a position where people have an Enlightenment experience, con other people into believing that this gives them some right to make law, and then proceed to boss their followers around like they're slaves. I think it's a scam. I don't see any evidence that the Enlightenment experience makes people better rulers. I don't see any evidence that the Enlightenment experience makes people fundamentally better at judging what is good for the long-term future of humanity.
What does it do? How is it good for the world if more people were enlightened?
First question, is it good for the world if more people are enlightened? Where's the evidence, right? This is what I mean about getting rid of the mythology. right? The mythology is more enlightened people will make the world a better place. The evidence is we've had lots of enlightened people and it's not really clear it's helping any. You see what I'm saying? And, you know, so you get kind of outstanding figures, right? You know, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, you know, Nelson Mandela. You know, you could look at some of the great sort of modern teachers of meditation, like D.T. Suzuki, the Zen guy. You could look at potentially people like Timothy Leary or Robert Anton Wilson, you know, Richard Alpert, who went on to become Ram Dass, Neem Karoli Baba, Yogiraj Gurunath Siddhanath, you know, who I've had some personal contact with. There's, you know, lots and lots and lots of these people are out there. I took a very strong initiation from Yogi Raj once. I'm not sure either he or I understood what was happening at all. So in these kind of processes, some being emerges, they step into a condition of historical need or historical necessity. They give people a set of instructions which appear to be appropriate to the time and the place. And often that will result in peace rather than war. But turns out that what you hope will be a lasting peace that will solve the entire problem turns out to be a temporary peace where another problem replaces the problem you had. Gandhi brings peace to India, but India is partitioned into two. One half goes on to get nuclear weapons, then the other half gets nuclear weapons, and they point the nuclear weapons at each other and they yell at each other over a border. Now, we can argue that this is not what Gandhi wanted, but it's certainly what Gandhi achieved. If they had gone ahead and had a genocide, and they'd had a war, there would have been one India, and there would have been no nuclear weapons pointed at the one India by the other half of the one India. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Depends who you ask, right? But the notion that Gandhi was in some way a god, that he came along, that he fixed the entire situation, and that he brought peace where otherwise there would have been war, it may be that he simply delayed the war by 60 years, and when the war arrived, it was nuclear. Progress? Maybe. So in this kind of context, this is what I mean about dismantling the mythology of enlightenment. Everybody wants to believe that there is a Santa Claus. Everybody wants to believe that if they do their work really hard, they're going to become the kind of person that can fix things just by standing near them. And if that is the case, why is the world not fixed? You see what I'm saying? So what we're back into is a sort of an economics of enlightenment. I think it's pretty clear that you can make an argument that there are a bunch of critical situations where if we hadn't had enlightened actors involved, you would have had immediate horrific consequences. I think the Indian partition is an obvious good example of that. It's also apparent that if you don't continue to have another bunch of enlightened people come along immediately after the first bunch and continue to maintain what happens, the bloody situation falls to pieces again immediately afterwards. So the first thing that I would hold out is the idea that enlightenment has lasting influence. I think in practice, you get people to do the job that they can do, and after they are gone, the situation passes into another pair of hands, and if those people are Muppets, pretty soon Muppetocracy reigns again. So I don't think this notion is that you just apply enlightenment to a situation and it's personal, perfectly, permanently resolved is remotely credible. I think it's an ongoing effort. Second thing is, I think that there are some jobs which are appropriate to enlightened people and there are some jobs which are appropriate to murderous psychopaths. I think that sending an enlightened person to do a murderous psychopath's job is not really a good idea, and the converse is certainly true. So if you think of a range of types of human consciousness, I think that there are different things which are appropriate to different people. And it's not at all clear to me that enlightened people are better than other people at everything. I don't think it necessarily happens that way at all. They tend to be kind of hypersensitive to external stimuli. They can be easily distracted. They're often kind of space cadets. They have a terrible tendency to assume that they're superior. They also have a tendency to ramble on about what's happening in other dimensions a lot, right? These are not necessarily the people that you want flying your jetliners, right? You see what I'm saying, right? So, you know, one way you could think of this is that enlightenment is an extreme form of artistic temperament.
Yeah.
Right? Now, what I don't want to do is create any confusion that there is no such thing as the enlightenment experience. So let me just really nail this down. There is definitely a thing called enlightenment. It is a very dramatic thing. If you've had the experience, you could tell other people who have had the experience more or less 100% reliably. I don't want to make an unnecessary parallel with sex, but it's not that different from you know, being in high school and people trying to guess who's had it and who hasn't, the people that have can, generally speaking, tell the people that haven't pretty fundamentally easily.
Yeah.
Right? So there is a thing there. It is a very objective thing. It is a thing that you can have. After you've had that thing, you see the world in a completely different way. Oh, that's what all the fuss is about. Right. So, yes, there is, you know, there is a Santa Claus in as much as there is a thing called enlightenment. It is possible to get there. After you've got there, it changes everything. But accept nobody's story about what it is. It's all medieval horseshit until proven otherwise. And it's extremely important that we do not carry the medieval myths along with the enlightenment process. Because if you bring the medieval myths along with you, you're going to wind up in a medieval future. And we can't afford a medieval future with nuclear weapons. We can't afford a medieval future with nanotechnology. If we're going to have an enlightenment tradition that actually works in the modern world, we have to have a modern enlightenment tradition that does not bring along all the medieval theocratic baggage with it. And I don't really see people doing that. I don't see any kind of concerted effort to demythologize enlightenment, to scrape the barnacles off the practices, and to figure out how to make the stuff actually good in the 21st century, rather than it being essentially the reenactment society for various feudal medieval theocracies. You know, I don't want Catholicism to prosper in the future. I don't want Islam to prosper in the future. I don't want Buddhism to prosper in the future. All of these have been political power structures. Right? The Indian tradition has a bit of an advantage in that to all, you know, whenever possible, we try and keep enlightened people out of politics. So we don't have quite the history of having our kind of, you know, god kings ruling over everything and telling everybody what to do. Usually the gods and the kings are kept in separate buckets. But, you know, Hinduism has a long and terrible history of doing awful things, just like all the other traditions have. So I think that the first thing we ought to consider is treating the historical records as being the gibberings of a bunch of medieval lunatics until proven otherwise. The how-to information is often accurate, but the actual, the world model that comes along with the how-to information is extremely dangerous. If they didn't understand biological evolution, and they didn't understand the framework of, you know, modern cosmology, everything they had to say about what a human being is and how we should treat each other is considered extremely suspect. And it's, if it's ingested as received truth just because some enlightened bastard said it, you're going to get poisoned. You don't accept the medicine of the 15th century, do not accept the enlightenment of the 15th century. Because they're still out there in the New Age world covering each other with leeches and pretending it will cure AIDS. And the enlightenment traditions that they're talking about are just as stupid.
So how do we start to modernize it?
Well, I mean, I think you just have to ask hard questions about what is it and what is it good for. And there's no real way to figure out what it is unless you actually sit down and do it. Right? And again, the medieval thing, oh my God, it's so difficult. Oh, you have to have a special car about this, that, and the next thing. No, you have to just not care about anything else for long enough that you actually get through the bloody workload. I mean, as far as I can tell, it is a mechanical grinding process for 85 or 95% of the process. And at the end of that, there's a whole bunch of fiddly stuff, which is basically a knack like playing a guitar or cracking a whip, where it's really important to have somebody show you how to do it because learning by yourself takes a century, right? So step one, gather data. The only mechanism we have for gathering data is to do the bloody work. Step two, if you have an enlightenment experience, you're lucky enough to get the breakthrough, don't take anything for granted when you want to tell yourself what just happened. Because the tendency that people have over and over and over again, we see it in history, is that you have an enlightenment experience and afterwards you grab onto the local mythology and interpret your experience using it.
Right. Mm. Yeah, I've seen that.
Right? And this is what forms the religious traditions of the world. People have enlightenment experiences, they repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat the myths that were given to them, and then they see the experience through the lens of that myth and the entire cycle continues forward. Right? I mean, no doubt that if you tell people, you know, that their first sexual experience is happening inside of some religious context, the experience is so powerful and so overwhelming, you're going to repeat the religious context indefinitely. And you could look at the conventions that we have around marriage as being that kind of structure. You take people at a moment of astonishing imprint vulnerability and they grab onto whatever convenient truth is around them and they reify it. They make that convenient truth into the absolute truth. And I think all of the evidence around us is that in the Enlightenment traditions are doing exactly that, and as a result, there's a whole bunch of medieval horse crap which is along for the ride, and we need to get rid of it. And I say that as somebody that is well-versed in the medieval horse crap. I really understand those systems in a ton of detail. I am completely convinced that they are all wrong.
Can you tell us a bit about the history for you and the process towards becoming enlightened?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me take a short break here and get some more tea.
Sure. Oh man, I have so many questions.
Yeah, it's quite a different way of looking at the problem. Let's put it that way. But I think it's super important for your listeners, you know, to really get an exposure to the idea that there is something real there, but you don't have to accept all the stories around it. Because if your listeners are at all intelligent and astute, they're going to be very, very, very clear that these stories are obviously nonsense. And the last thing I want is for people to say, well, the stories are nonsense, therefore there's no such animal. You know, the stories are nonsense, but that doesn't mean there's no such animal. The stories are nonsense because they're pre-scientific. Almost everything which is pre-scientific is nonsense. We didn't have a repeatable procedure for discriminating the nonsense from the sense until we got science. And that's pretty much what science is for. And, you know, it blows my mind that I see otherwise intelligent and reasonable people standing up and repeating whatever medieval horse crap they were given when they got enlightened as if it was a simple, obvious, absolute truth. You know, are you crazy? Why on earth would you believe that? Have you seen it yourself? Is there evidence? People look at like you're mad for asking. So you guys are in Bulgaria now?
Yeah, we are. So we were in Portugal for a few months, and Portugal it wasn't so much the place, it was just the meditation practice, I think, for both of us was really well established, and we had a really good routine with it. So we started having these experiences, and like you say, like scraping away the muck and seeing the jewel underneath, like there were many times where we got... it felt like almost to the other side. I'll speak for myself, but
mm-hmm. Yeah,
it just kind of waved in and out. But yeah,
that sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
I guess I'm still trying to figure out what the value of spiritual experience is, because I've had several very intense ones. Like one time I was meditating, actually several times I was meditating, and I just like slingshot into outer space, and like my body dissolved, and I was the universe. Like outside of time. Obviously it's a very fantastical experience, but how do you integrate it in your everyday life? And like, what's the value of this kind of stuff? Is there value in it?
Well, you know, let's have a think about this, right? Again, historical context, right? Given that these things are being done by human beings, the biological context that we arose in is critical, because that's what a human being is to all intents and purposes. And you know, we need to put these things into a cultural context. So if we go back 1,000 years and people were having those experiences, we didn't have any scientific model. So let's say for a moment that what you're getting by some weird occult means is a glimpse into the way that things actually are. You have this experience of your body dissolving, your consciousness is immersed in light. Wow, I'm actually seeing something that's here. If that's happening in an environment where there is no procedural method of getting to truth, you're going to wind up thinking that that experience is fundamentally a way of seeing what is underneath the real world. Underneath the real world is infinite light, right? Kind of see what I'm saying about how you would interpret that if you had no access to science?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got access to science, right? When you say floating in space, do we mean space like a literal space, or do you mean space like it's something inside of our heads? So, this sort of notion that you've got to think about the things that we objectively know to be real, and then you have to think about your experiences relative to that, this is kind of where the position is, where if you keep your grip, you wind up rational and useful, and if you lose your grip, you wind up as New Age, you know, idiots that really need to be fed into wood chippers. The knowledge which comes from meditation is certainly very, very, very convincing. It can often allow you to do things that are completely unreasonably effective relative to other things. You go deep inside of yourself, you think and you meditate and you feel, you come back to the surface with a firm conviction that you understand the situation, and then you act. 9 times out of 10, you'll turn out to be in harmony with the situation in ways which are completely transformative. There is deep knowledge inside of us when you can get at it. It's very transformative for what's around us. And that's fairly well established. I think you can see a pretty good track record of heavyweight mystical people that then go off into the world and get a lot of stuff done. Problem is, if they fit it inside of the theology, which assumes a whole bunch of things which are completely not true, like God hates humanity and runs an infinite dungeon called hell where the evildoers are punished for all eternity, then all the sort of deep wisdom inside of the person is then twisted by the false knowledge that they're carrying along with them. And that, to me, is the tragedy of religion, that it fuses what is real knowledge from deep inside of us with false knowledge from outside of us into something which is passed down as if it was a divinely received truth. I cannot tell you what is happening to you. I don't think the science is there yet. I can tell you what the medieval people from my tradition say is happening, but if I repeat that to you as if it's truth, I'm lying to you because I know damn well that it isn't. I know more about how a human being is made than they did. And I know more because I live in a culture that has access to things like epigenetics. Right? We know that genes are turning off and on in our bodies when we eat different foods. We know that some of that material is passed down to our children if we have them. That's a new knowledge. We didn't have that 1 million years ago. We didn't have that 1,000 years ago. We didn't have that 100 years ago. We barely had it 10 years ago. So all of these experiences have to be slotted in to the available cultural knowledge base around you. Right? And this is just, I can't express how important it is that if you're looking at material that comes from the distant past, their ideas about the nature of the human body and the nature of the universe around us were so imperfect that whatever wisdom that was coming out of them in the meditation process was being immediately received into total ignorance of the fundamentals of human existence. You see how dangerous that could be, right? And you've got, a 2.5, 3, 4 billion strong army of people that are completely sure of these medieval truths and are willing to kill each other over them. And the people that get enlightened inside of those reality tunnels, inside of those medieval frameworks, take their full certainty that comes with the spiritual experience, and they take this awful theocratic mumbo-jumbo, they fuse them together, and then they go forth and march forward with a sword hung in the air. Right? So if the Enlightenment experience is received in a way that turns into dogmatic certainty that the local religion is absolutely true, I think it's one of the most poisonous things there is. I think what we, I don't want to say what we need, but I think what is extremely valuable about the present time is that you can have the Enlightenment experience while remaining in a condition of rational scientific doubt. And, this is essentially Saganism. I don't know whether Carl Sagan was formerly enlightened or not, but he certainly has many of the attributes of an enlightened being. I never met the man, I wish I had. I grew up on his work, had an enormous influence on me. And if we imagine for a moment that Carl Sagan was enlightened, that's what scientific enlightenment looks like. You have the absolute sense of wonder and rapture that comes with the Enlightenment experience, and you experience that wonder and rapture in the full context of what you're seeing is objectively real. And this is really worthwhile. The kind of poetic wonder that comes along with Enlightenment is a really strong thing, but maybe best that we have that poetic wonder about things which are actually there, like our DNA, rather than counting the angels that may or may not dance on the heads of pins. I don't want people spending their Enlightenment experience cataloguing the attributes of a non-existent God. But I think it's pretty cool that your body is essentially a billion-year-old poem. I mean, there are rhyming couplets inside of your DNA that go all the way back to the beginning of time. I don't know how old the oldest gene is in the human body, but I bet there are sequences of DNA where one thing follows another, in a sequence of base pairs. I bet there are sequences that go back hundreds of millions of years largely unchanged. Quite amazing. But I would much rather, have a tradition in which we just accepted that the ignorance about the fundamentals of life is not affected by enlightenment. You get certainty about something, but the something that you get certainty of does not allow you to look around corners. It doesn't allow you to suddenly, mysteriously know the fundamental structures of the world around you. It gives the illusion that it does, which is why all the medievals were so certain that this stuff was important. But, all of the objective evidence says it's an illusion, because if it really converged, all of the world's religions would come to the same conclusions about all the major stuff, and it's just not true. They don't. Do you see how important this is in terms of a context?
Yeah.
And, I was raised, my guru was completely certain that all the religious truths converged. And if I went along with that at an emotional level, sure enough, it looked kind of true. But if you disengage, you know, from the kind of wish for it to be true and actually stop and say, right, what do they actually believe? What is written down? What do they practice? They're in different universes. Making sense so far?
Yeah. I've thought about this before, what it's like to have an enlightenment experience and then come back and filter it through your normal rational mind and filter it through whatever kind of symbolism or upbringing that you have. And I can see how easily it would go awry with religion and any kind of ancient dogma.
Or modern dogma.
Or modern, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You bet. I mean, all of these UFO people, you know? I mean, it's pretty clear they're having some kind of spiritual experience, mystical experience, but, you know, they come back with this complete certainty of all their UFO cult stuff. No, we can't be having that. That's just, it's just not there. I mean, you guys have spent a bunch of time around hippies or moving around hippie circles, festival circuits, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. You'd be more so than I.
So you ever come across these kind of like skinny, muscular white guys that just can't stop moving? They usually have dreadlocks. You know, their speech is very, very, very charismatic, very persuasive. They almost never stop talking. Their bodies never stop moving. And all that they're interested in is telling you how fantastic magic mushrooms are.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that taking magic mushrooms makes you want to get other people to take magic mushrooms is kind of a replicator behavior.
Yeah.
It's like a meme, right?
Uh-huh.
It's something between, you know, somehow they've become part of the mushroom propagation process.
No kidding. Like the plants have hijacked humans to do their bidding.
Terrence McKenna talked about that, actually. That's hilarious.
Right. So I think you've got to assume that the religious processes are doing something similar to the Enlightenment experience. That a lot of what's happening in the religions is we're creating contexts where the naturally occurring Enlightenment processes are being shepherded in to a set of, you know, kind of channels which cause them to replicate a whole bunch of material which has nothing to do with the Enlightenment process along the way.
While we're on the subject of psychedelics, do you find that that plays a role in experiences of Enlightenment?
Yes. I mean, the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali has five mechanisms by which you can get enlightened. And one of those mechanisms is clearly a reference to psychedelics. Shows up in a couple of places in the Tibetan literature. And, you know, in Indian yoga circles today, if you go off into the mountains, they're still, you know, on the jungle juice. I was part of a very large, kind of broad psychedelic breakout in the 1990s. You know, there were people doing psychedelics everywhere, all over Europe, all over America. You'd always meet people that were into that stuff or on that stuff. You know, you'd go to something like Burning Man. It was just an enormous wave of interest in psychedelia. A lot of casualties. A lot of casualties. I mean, I would say maybe a third of the people that I knew that were heavily into psychedelics came out from the experience a bit worse than they went in. And quite a few people had psychotic breaks and were never the same again. I think it's clear that a lot of people do have enormously profound life-transforming experiences. But there's a ton of academic research on treating post-traumatic stress disorder with psychedelics, which I think is incredibly important. Depression with psychedelics, incredibly important. You know, so I think that we're in a position where with appropriate clinical harnesses, medicalization, this kind of stuff, you could potentially get a psychedelic culture that was both safe and effective. But right now, what I see in psychedelic culture is it's not safe or effective. And there's a folklore around psychedelia, which has most of the same attributes of this kind of like self-replicating bullshit that we see in religions. Terence McKenna is a good case in point, right? 2012, did anything actually happen? Nothing, right? And how certain was Terence McKenna that it was coming? Really certain. Really solidly, powerfully, evangelically certain, it ain't there. So this to me is the, you know, the fundamental breaking point is we've got to stop thinking that just because somebody enlightened said it, it's true. We've got to start accepting that enlightenment is a natural human process. It happens to people. It is not something that automatically, intellectually purifies their environment and makes everything around them true. And human beings who've just had the Enlightenment experience tend to fall back on what they know as a way of explaining what's happened to them. And that set of mechanisms explains to me, I don't know, 85% of what's happening around Enlightenment. Natural human process that can be facilitated in much the same way that marathon running is an extension of a natural human process. At the point of Enlightenment, whatever stuff that people have kicking around in their heads as an explanatory framework becomes activated, they will then tend to assume that that is what exactly happened to them in objective forms, and they have a terrible tendency of then teaching that stuff as if it was absolute truth. And I think we can see that pattern replicated across culture after culture after culture after culture. Clearly, most of the people that are out there proclaiming these absolute truths are talking nonsense. They don't agree with each other. If they all agreed and it was all fundamentally the same stuff, we could argue that they're seeing an objective truth. They don't agree with each other about more than a few things, like, oh, it's all really cosmic and wonderful and time and space are really big. But there's not really a fine detailed grasp of something fundamental which is properly objective. Because if there was, in all probability, these people would agree with each other about those fundamentals. And the lack of agreement about the fundamentals is extremely important. Nothing that we can do makes it possible to reconcile the world's religious traditions with each other in the detail, even on the broad general principles they disagree. And in person, the people from those traditions that are enlightened are often very friendly to each other and get along really well, but they're not in the habit of turning around and saying, well, you know, actually the stuff that we all agree about is much more important than all this traditional nonsense and we're just going to chuck it out. I don't really care what the Buddha said, he's not here today. But I think that's what it's going to take for us to get enlightenment into a position where we can get science and enlightenment on the same side. And I think that we have to do that because science is the best thing there is. I mean, I can't stress this too strongly. You know, I come from a tradition which is arguably 8,000 years old, and we didn't know what human beings were until Darwin. You see what I'm saying? You know, I think it's reasonable to say, right? Sometimes when people push me on it, I say I'm post-Hindu, right? You know, I think the ancient Hindus, if they'd understood biology at all, if they'd understood evolution, I'm completely convinced the ancient Hindus would have taught it as Hinduism. Ah, yes, well, you know, we're here to tell you that, you know, this whole thing is actually produced by a very simple mechanism. It works like this, and you're a part of it. And to me, that represents the next step forward in the history of, you know, human relationship with the infinite cosmic mysterious unknown. We have to bring our science into the mystical domain, and we have to bring our mysticism into the scientific domain. And I don't mean that in a sense of, like, you know, one day quantum physics will prove that Buddhism is the truth. If it does, great. If it doesn't, no big deal. What I mean is that we have to bring the same sharpness of attention which caused us to be able to make discoveries like evolution or relativity, and we have to bring that into the domain of consciousness exploration, consciousness study. Bring the lab coat. Wear the lab coat. You're in the lab coat, right? What am I going to do? I'm going to explore my mind, and I'm going to find out exactly what's going on in there. If you get that process right, you see the chink of light. If you go all the way through the process of revealing that chink of light fully, you become enlightened. But I just can't stress it too strongly. Don't grab on to the traditional stories about what just happened if that happens to you. Grab on to the science. Okay, so I've had this experience. I'm in a body that I know for sure evolved. We don't really understand what consciousness is yet. The jury is still out on that one. Right, okay, I have an unknown here. And if you experience this as an unknown, I've got some new data, I don't think you fall into error that way. You know, it took me 3 years of work, maybe 4 or 5 actually, to fully reconcile the fact that I could not get any evidence that they knew about evolution in Hinduism fully worked through my system. It was a fundamental break in my world model, because up until that point, I really believed that the enlightened masters of the past had recorded the truth about everything that was around me. Right, I thought that they fundamentally understood human nature better than the moderns did. And then it really, you know, chipped away at my certainty. Like, wait a minute. Where's the evolution? You know, the day when I figured out that you could have taught evolution to a 7,000-year-old, you know, a goat herder 7,000 years ago, you know, that really means something. Well, we could actually have gotten this across to these people. If the enlightened masters knew it, why didn't they teach it? And that was a fundamental break in my world model that took me years to work through. Okay, so in that case, we're not seeing absolute truth through enlightenment. What exactly is it that happened to me? I went back over the experience and I looked at it and I recreated bits of it and I went backwards and forwards, really, really, really putting it under the microscope. And, you know, I can describe a bit more about the experience, but, you know, given that we're talking about the cultural constructs and the stuff around it, you know, the absolute bedrock here is, if it's so great, why didn't they beat Darwin? Why did it take an English guy a couple of hundred years ago with an obsession with, you know, finches and beetles to actually resolve the question of what are human beings? And, you know, you and I have both grown up knowing what human beings are because Darwin is the first guy that noticed. Up until Darwin, we didn't know what nature did. Why does a human being exist? Well, you know, God made one out of plasticine one day. Really? No, I got a better story for you. Replicating molecules, and you can see them today. Right. So once you get Darwin as the fundamental base layer, you're not going to stray very far when it comes to questions about human nature. You're not going to stray very far in questions of human origins. This doesn't mean that there is nothing unresolved about consciousness. The Enlightenment experience shows you immensities about consciousness, most of which are completely unscientific and almost impossible to describe. Oh my God, the overwhelming nature of the Enlightened response to consciousness. Oh my God, and the perceptive shifts that come afterwards. This stuff is epic, it's immense. It makes the psychedelic experience look relatively weak. No doubt all that stuff is actually there. Oh my God, it's epic. But, you know, I don't want the next generation of people having their Enlightenment experiences and then becoming drones in the replicating structure of these medieval theocracies. Not even my medieval theocracy. You know, I come from medieval theocracy. You're more than welcome to have some of my medieval theocracy, but it's not actually good for you. The only thing that I can give you that resembles durable truth is stick close to Darwin and hope that the physicists sort their crap out so we get a cosmology that makes sense.
So I think we laid a pretty good groundwork here for what it is not and what to watch out for, but I'm interested to hear your perspective on the experience.
All right, strap in.
All right, so this concludes the first portion of our interview with Vinay about Enlightenment. In the next one, we're going to get into more of the mechanics and the how-to, and also Vinay's experience with Enlightenment. In the meantime, if you guys want to check out any of the stuff we talked about and also the article that goes along with this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/enlightenment. And if you guys want to help us make more episodes and more frequently, consider becoming a patron. You can go to patreon.com/futurethinkers.
And if you don't have the spare cash lying around, don't worry about it. You can still help with the show by leaving us a rating on iTunes or review and sharing the show with your friends. It helps out more than you might think. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode. Bye.